On the fifth floor of the gleaming research facility at Stowers Institute, Scott Hawley oversees a team of about 13 researchers. They're looking at the genetics of fruit flies, genus Drosophila, using the state-of-the-art technology, including one of the world's only fly robots. His office sits near the lab, and if I had to imagine the office of a geneticist, just make it up in my own head, it would truly look a whole lot like Scott's office. Equations hastily scribbled on a dry erase board and a picture of Einstein on the wall with a quote that says, "If we knew what we were doing, it would not be called research." I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're playing back our conversation with Scott Hawley. He's a fascinating guy with a really intense personal story that inspires his research. Scott Hawley, good morning.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
You are a PI at Stowers. That's a principal investigator. What does that mean exactly, other than getting a lab with your name on the door?
That's pretty much it. But it basically means that I'm privileged to lead a lab of 13 of the most amazing people I know and work on a common project and also interact with some of the best scientists in the world and to have access to some of the best research facilities that exist anywhere.
What does investigator mean? I mean, it's sort of interesting to me. I'm familiar with, you know, you say like Professor so-and-so or Dr. so-and-so. Investigator is an interesting term.
Yeah, it was a term that was arrived at after a lot of thinking about other things. And we didn't call ourselves professors because at that time we weren't a university. And so professor didn't seem quite right. And at first we started calling ourselves senior scientists, which I liked. But our equivalent of assistant professors weren't wild about being called junior scientists. That sounded like they should be getting a new chemistry set.
Yeah.
And so we actually spent time on this, trying to come up for a name which was respectful of each group of people, people starting their career as scientists, the people who are so often people who bring in incredible ideas and energy, people who are mid-career, and people who've reached a sort of senior level. And we finally decided that what is it we do? Well, we investigate biological phenomena. And it was a great term. It was a term that had meaning from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. They had helped define it and give that word some strength and credibility. And we followed it and it's worked.
What biological phenomena or phenomenon do you study?
So I'm interested in a process called meiosis. And meiosis is how the body manages every time it makes a sperm or an egg to get the right number of chromosomes into that egg. So each of us has 46 chromosomes. But when we build a sperm or an egg, we have to get 23 of those 46 chromosomes in there. Not only do we have to get 23, it has to be the right 23. So we have to pull off this amazing process in the cells that are going to do this. And the first thing they have to do is they have to take the chromosome 1 you got from your mother and the chromosome 1 you got from your dad. And you have to put them together. It's a process we call pairing.
Can I jump in here? Because I'm kind of surprised that this is like, I guess I'll just say, and I remember high school biology learning about chromosomes and the double helix structure, which is like kind of a twisted zipper in some ways is what it looks like. And then according to diagrams that were drawn in these classes, it actually made it appear quite simple, like just that you just unzip this thing.
Well,
and voila,
you
half
know,
of them.
As I point out sometimes, the reason that textbooks make some of these processes sound so simple, and the reason that in most undergraduate, first year biology classes, they go through things like meiosis so quickly, is the paralyzing fear that someone's going to ask how it works.
Yeah, how and the teacher can't answer.
Yeah. How do two chromosomes pair? I mean, I have to tell you, at the moment, pretty much the best mechanism we have for how pairing works is, and then a miracle happens. Okay. It's hard for me to believe that more than a century after the description of the meiotic process, I can't tell you how two homologous chromosomes pair. And yet, if you think about it, it's one of those fundamental questions of knowledge, isn't it? I mean, it's how do I tell me from somebody else? How do I recognize my partner in this group of 45 other chromosomes, as opposed to the 44 other chromosomes that aren't my partner? How do I recognize myself?
So give us a refresher on some basic things. Some of them are things that I think most of us believe we know, but maybe don't think about a whole lot. This is a very basic question, but I mean, what do chromosomes do? What is their function in our bodies?
Well, at one level, you can think of them as gigantic moving vans, right? They carry your genes. So you have 23 pairs of chromosomes, and the 20-some thousand genes you have, well, you actually have two copies of each one, so the 40,000, almost 50,000 genes you have, are carried on those chromosomes, like long strings of pearls, right? And part of the job of chromosomes is to see to it that you move those things properly every time you divide, right? It enables the cell to move all of its genes around in a convenient fashion. In addition, chromosomes also play roles in determining where genes are in the nucleus, in determining what genes are active, what genes aren't active. And so these sort of structures in the cell take on meaning both in terms of moving genes, regulating genes, controlling genes' position, controlling the interaction of genes with the other copy of the gene from the other.
And those things
pair.
Determine what about me, like if we're talking about my genes?
Well, they determine, the way I say is, talk about it is that genes determine sort of limits. Like they determine probably how tall you can be, provided you get the appropriate care as a child and you get proper nutrition and proper medical care, etc. Your genes are probably going to determine how tall you can be. Your genes can determine what diseases you might be susceptible to. In some cases, the genes are destiny, and they will determine what diseases you're going to get. They also influence a bunch of other things in the context of the environment. And that's when things get hard, when we start talking about what we call complex traits or multifactorial inheritance, where we're having to talk about many genes and especially their interaction with the environment. And that's when we actually have to start really doing our work.
And so the meiosis, when it splits apart in pairs, or it's just one of those?
Pairs.
Pairs, because the other one is mitosis.
Well, no, mitosis, no. If you think about it this way.
Getting carried away remembering biology class.
Yeah, we're going a little fast. So you have a father, and he has 46 chromosomes. He's got one from mom, one from dad. 23 from each parent. And mom has 46, 23 from each of her parents. Now they need to build a sperm and an egg. Each sperm has to have 23, one of each pair. Each egg has to have 23, one of each pair. And then they have to come together to form 46. Great. We got a zygote. Wonderful. Okay. You know, it's just amazing. I can still remember the first time I saw Star Wars when I was in graduate school. And here's this Imperial Death Star, you know, it can stay in space forever. And here's Luke Skywalker in this little X-Wing fighter. And he comes down on the surface of the Death Star and he goes into this little canal and he's looping around. And there's all this energy. And all of a sudden he fires this photon torpedo. And it goes into the Death Star, and there's this huge explosion of energy. And I turn to the girl I was out with, and I go, that's fertilization. She'd never go out with me again, which is why you don't date science nerds, okay? But the thing is that that's really what it's all about. You bring that 23 chromosomes from dad together with that 23 chromosomes from mom. You've got this zygote with the capacity to build an entirely new human being. All the planning, all the instruction to build a human, but then you have to do it. And so you have to take this single cell with 46 chromosomes, and you have to divide that enough times pretty quickly to get 10 trillion cells to build a people.
That's pretty crazy.
It's amazing that it works.
And so we are, you know, I guess like science can feel really abstract and inaccessible to non-scientists, especially when people explain it not using metaphors involving Star Wars and moving vans and things. I mean, you explain science in pretty relatable terms. But I mean, when I think about, for example, the equations I saw on your dry erase board, I am not actually 100% sure those are equations. That's how little I understand them. But the questions that drive you are essentially human questions. What's at stake on a human level in the research that you are doing?
So what drives my research is about 20 years ago, one of my postdoctoral fellows walked into my office at around 9 o'clock at night, and he sort of stood in the doorway. And what was bugging him was that what had been bugging me all day was a case where chromosome segregation had gone wrong in a normal fruit fly, and I couldn't find a reason for it. And that was really bugging me. And of course, I was then bugging the people in my lab because that's what I do. And he walked into my office and he looked at me and he goes, you really do think meiosis is perfect, don't you? And I looked up from my computer. What is this? And he's, can't you just let it make a mistake every now and then? Well, it does make mistakes every now and then. And the problem is in human beings, when mistakes are made in terms of segregating chromosomes at meiosis, the consequences are either a zygote that can't flourish, in other words, a zygote that's not going to be able to make it to term, or, and that's what happens most of the time, or in certain cases, individuals who are going to have to cope with a complex set of effects resulting from having the wrong number of chromosomes. And these are, you know, these are people, and they're trying to deal with very difficult disorders, and these are people, many of whom I know, and I hear their stories, and it's something that really matters to me. I want to understand how this process works.
It matters to you because of something you experienced in your childhood, and I'd like you to tell that story. It's a really fascinating and kind of crazy story.
It really is. So when I was about 12 or 13, I had a series of three epileptic seizures, which bothered the family dog more than I think it bothered anybody else. But it really bothered the state of California.
And that's where you lived?
Yeah. And so because I had epilepsy, and epilepsy is a sort of big deal. I mean, I had been given an almanac, right? And I discovered that there were five states in the union where you couldn't get married if you had epilepsy. It goes back to, you know, Middle Ages ideas about demonic possession and stuff like that. But, you know, epilepsy was sort of a big deal. And so the state of California said, you can't be in regular PE class. You have to be in this PE class called modified PE. There were uglier terms for it, but that's the one I'm going to use this morning. And I spent the next 4 years, 1 hour a day, 5 days a week, in that class with kids who had a lot of really severe disabilities, mostly disabilities they'd been born with. And I watched how the world treated them.
The world in the form of physical education teachers?
Well, those and also high school. I mean, one of the stories that I'll probably live another 20 years and never be able to get out of my mind is one day after class walking down the hallway with one of these kids and one of the other kids in the class, and one of our high school superstars deliberately stuck his foot out and tripped this kid. And this kid just fell face forward, you know, face hits the linoleum. And, you know, there's blood and he's crying and stuff like that. And everyone's laughing. And when he got up and I wanted to take him to the nurse's station, what he couldn't accept, I mean, it didn't bother him that he'd fallen. It didn't bother him that he was bleeding. He couldn't understand why people were laughing at him. He couldn't figure out why this was funny. And I couldn't explain it.
Because it's not.
Because it's not. And so why were people laughing at him, right? And it just kept making me angrier and angrier. And remember, this is the late 60s, the beginning of the 70s, and there were people out there fighting for everybody. You know, Dr. King, the Reverend Dr. King, and Cesar Chavez, and the beginning of the women's movement, and even the beginning of the gay rights movement. And what I saw were so many people out there, but I didn't realize that there were people out there who would eventually go on to do things like the American Disabilities Act, who were worried about these kids. And so I went to college and I wanted to do something for these kids. That was my big goal in life, right? And I ended up being randomly assigned to a college advisor named Crellin Pauling, whose father was Linus Pauling, who won the Nobel Prize, right, for the chemical bond. And Crellin claims, because he was a friend for a long time, that he basically let me rant in his office for 20 minutes. I don't remember that, but he said that he then, what I remember is he looked at me and goes, I don't know whether you're naive or just stupid. And I just went, what? You're calling me stupid? And he goes, look at what people will discriminate against other people on the grounds of. Minor things. You think you're going to get them to not discriminate against, you know, serious developmental defects? And I'm sort of sitting there staring. He goes, you want to do something to help these kids? You want to do something? He goes, why don't you try and fix it or prevent it? And I'm like, you can't do that. And he's like, well, you can't unless you try.
Well, I want to back up before we get into how you went about trying to do that and the shift that you experienced at this moment, because it intrigues me that even as a young, I mean, high school age person, that you saw something like this and pretty quickly responded to it by wanting to do something about it. not that, I mean, that's great, but I, at that age, I feel like a lot of kids would either just see it and feel some kind of pain that they couldn't quite put a label on, or feel embarrassed, or feel confused, and kind of stuff that away. You know what I mean? And you were very conscious not only of how it was affecting you, but you kind of zeroed in on it and turned it into a lifelong project. And that seems kind of, you know, that didn't have to be how you responded to that. Do you have a sense of what it was about who you were at that time that this really resonated with?
Books, right? I mean, I was reading far too much science fiction, but one of the things that was most formative in my life was a story by the science fiction writer Harlan Ellison called Repent, Harlequins of the TikTok Man. And it was about the price of being different and the consequence of being different. And at the same time, I was also reading, you know, Mallory's King Arthur books. And I kept coming back to what it meant to be different in the society, what the price was for being different. And I kept coming back to, why does it have to be so high? Isn't it the people who are different who make this world as wonderful as it is? Why is there such a high price? Why are people constantly encouraging me to just try a little more conformity when it seemed to me that conformity was the last thing we needed?
You originally thought you were going to become a lawyer to defend people against this kind of, I don't know, prejudice that they were experiencing.
I did. I had a really, you know, I had a really big thing for Clarence Darrow, and I had read the Scopes trial, and I read Inherit the Wind more times than I wanted to, but I probably should have. I really thought that I could go out there and make a difference, you know, and it was really a major thing for me. But you know, once I took a genetics class and I realized that maybe someday we could do something about some of these issues, and the other was, and this is totally selfish, I fell in love with the intellectual beauty of genetics as a science.
Describe that to me.
Genetics is kind of the algebra of biology. It's a way of thinking, and it's a set of tools that enables you to what a Nobel Prize winner named Lee Hartwell, an incredible geneticist and one of my professors in graduate schools, called the surgical power of genetics. It's the ability to go into a genome that has 26,000 genes or 14,000 like fruit flies do, and be able to identify that small number of genes that specifically controls the process you're interested in, understand what those genes do, how they function, and then begin to understand what happens when they don't do their job, when they're not right.
This is kind of a strange question maybe, but I understand how genetics can help prevent the kinds of conditions kids were dealing with that you witnessed. Is there a way that genetics and like the knowledge that you can gain about those conditions, is there a way that can also prevent the, I guess, meanness they experienced?
Well, what I'm hoping is that as people begin to realize, there's actually a title in one of the books I wrote called We're All Mutants, that all of us are carrying variants in a large number of genes, that we all have deleterious genes for deleterious mutants for some specific genes. We're all carrying around this complex set of things, which together with our environment helps make us what we are. And I'm hoping that people will gradually realize that more important than the difference is the commonality. We're all sharing this genome. We're all trying to do the best we can with what we have.
When you talk about, you know, look, the beauty of genetics, that you fell in love with that, and we talk about things like chromosomes and stuff like that. Most of us have only seen diagrams of those things or heard about them. You, using various kinds of imaging and technology, can actually kind of observe a lot of these processes. Do you remember the first time you went from reading about genetics to observing some aspect of genetics in action?
Yeah, I really do. I remember being an undergraduate working in a laboratory, and I remember the first time I actually saw a fly that had to be the result of an error in meiosis. And I remember just going, oh my gosh. And then I certainly remember the first time I recovered a new mutant, one that people hadn't seen before, that affected the meiotic process. Because it was on Christmas Eve, and I was in the lab doing work for my graduate student who was taking the day off. And we can discuss why it was that she was taking the day off and I was in the lab doing her work. But that's a separate issue.
You sound like a nice boss.
I think there's people listening right now who would not agree. But nonetheless, when I saw this progeny, you know, that was awesome. It's like,
what did you see that made you know that this was a mutant?
There were certain characteristics in the progeny of this female. So the way certain things were being inherited. And from my training, from my experience, when I saw this in the numbers that I was seeing it, it
didn't... What things? I mean, I don't... What things do you see on a fruit?
Different eye colors, different wing shapes, different body colors. Fruit flies are as different from each other in some ways as, you know, as humans are. There's this tremendous genetic variation in appearance. And, you know, you can recognize certain things.
So you notice that there's something going on here. It's Christmas Eve.
I just got an incredible present, you know, because I got this thing to work on, right? My graduate student wasn't so enthused.
You got mutant fruit flies for Christmas.
I got mutant fruit flies, yeah. And it's really wonderful. And I was really excited. So, and we still actually work on that mutant. So,
you know, do you, when you go into the, I mean, it's mostly other people in the lab. You're kind of supervising.
Uh-huh.
And so.
They're laughing right now.
when you go to work, do you still think about the big questions and kind of the fight you had in you that sent you down this path? Or do you go in focused on more day-to-day kinds of things?
Both. I mean, I'm very involved with organizations that cope with kinds of genetic problems in humans. We've spent a lot of time recently, myself and one of my former graduate students, thinking about the cause of certain kinds of disabilities and really the breadth of things associated with this disorder called Turner syndrome. You know, Turner syndrome is this incredible phenomenon where you have it's supposed to be having only one copy of the X chromosome in a woman. She's supposed to have two and she only has one. And if you look on Wikipedia, it'll tell you what this disorder is about. And then you meet someone with Turner syndrome and you go, I don't even recognize this, because it's very likely that they might not show any of the things. But you begin to wonder, well, if this is all one genetic disorder, why is there this tremendous amount of variation? And what can we do? What can we learn about genetics that's going to help us know which girls, which women may need help or benefit from help when they're young, so that they can really be able to cope with this disorder as easily as possible? And when you do that, and, you know, I recently had a woman who leads a Turner syndrome research group and has a daughter with Turner's actually come and talk to my lab. And it was amazing for us to sort of spend a couple of hours with her and realize this is the humanity of what we do. This is why we do what we do, is to help understand the etiology of these kinds of problems in humans.
When you talked before about wanting to be a lawyer, I'm thinking about what is the difference between what you're describing and what a lawyer does. I'm not an expert in either genetics or law, but it seems like when you keep talking about variation and the ability of the process to make a mistake, that in some ways seems like the difference, because law attempts to make rules.
Well, genetics is about cherishing the exceptions, right? Genetics is about understanding when things go wrong and appreciating those.
Well, when KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll get more on what's going on in geneticist Scott Hawley's lab at the Stowers Institute. We'll also find out about his poetry. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's next. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today's show is an encore presentation of our portrait session with geneticist Scott Hawley. He's a principal investigator at Stowers and also a poet. We'll get to that. Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, okay, let's quickly recap in the simplest terms possible what it is you do in case someone's just tuned in.
So I run a laboratory, at least I think I run it, of 13 people, amazing people. I'm also the dean of the graduate school at the Stowers Institute.
When did you start doing the research in the area you do now with fruit flies?
In 1973.
What is it, and this might be a long answer, and I'm okay with that, what is it that we know now that we didn't know then?
We know the genome. We can identify most of the genes. And it gives us a tremendous amount of power. You know, I have colleagues who work with human geneticists who are capable of, when a specific disorder has been mapped to a specific region in the human genome, they're able to look at the similar region in the fly genome, be able to go through the genes in that region very quickly and say, ah, this is the gene which, if you knocked it out in flies, would have a defect similar to what you're seeing in a human. Take a look at that gene in detail. We see this over and over again because, you know, nature keeps using the same toolbox over and over. And because we can move so quickly in flies and in yeast and in worms in our so-called model organisms, we can get things done so quickly.
When you say that nature uses the same toolbox over and over again, can you help me understand what you mean by that?
Yeah. So if you want to build a specific structure, you know, heaven knows how many species there are on the planet, but they have not all, they don't all do it in different ways. Sometimes it seems like it. But in fact, for the most part, most of the genes in flies have functional homologs in humans and in yeast and in worms. And so they're basically using the same building blocks over and over. And that means what we can learn about a gene in one organism, especially a simple organism where we can move quickly, often is informative about what's going on in a human being. Same thing with processes.
How do you study genes? I mean, my knowledge of DNA, as I've explained, I mean, it's there are X's and there are Y's and there is a double helix, but I don't have any clue how someone actually goes about, like you were saying, observing a gene or working with DNA. It is tiny, as I am led to believe. And I guess this is going to sound possibly just incredibly ignorant, but I don't actually understand where it is. I know I have DNA, but I don't know if it's everywhere or if it's in some places and it's just sending the messages that make all this stuff.
It is in virtually all of your cells. The only real exception is your red blood cells. All of your cells have the full complement of your genes, which is kind of interesting because it means your liver cells have the same genes as the cells in your eye, except they're expressing different sets of those genes. It's like a symphony that can play different pieces of music by controlling which instruments are played when. And that's a huge part of what we're trying to understand is...
But there's not just one symphony in this orchestra hall. The symphony is everywhere.
The symphony is everywhere. You know, you have a symphony in every cell, an orchestra in every cell. And so you're trying to understand how those cells do things. And then in terms of the ways in which we study, we used to study by classical genetic means. In other words, we'd try and get a mutant in a gene and look at what's wrong. Now we have so many tools. I mean,
so you'd look at the organism itself and how it's behaving to try and understand what the genes are doing that would make that happen.
Right. And so we'd make a mutant in gene X and try and figure out what happens. Okay. And depending on what happens, we'd say, well, gene X does this because if it's not there, then this process doesn't occur. But now we have so many other tools because of the tremendous gift that is molecular biology. And, you know, we can sequence entire genomes. We can do it quickly. We can do it inexpensively. We have an amazing facility at Stowers that lets us do that. I mean,
imaging is part of that, right?
And imaging is huge in terms of being able to look at chromosomes and follow their behavior. And again, we have an amazing core that, you know, is just so, so incredible in terms of our imaging core. It's amazing to me, Gina. You know, I was taught things in college. And like one of the things I tell my students every year is, I went back a few years ago and I went through my college genetics notes from 1972, right? And 60% of what was in there was wrong, right? But what the only part that was useful was process. How do you figure things out? That's still how we figure stuff out. And I grew up believing that, you know, you could only tell objects that were this far apart with...
like an inch?
Whatever, with a given kind, with light microscopy. I've been watching that go, well, yeah, but now you can make it less using this technique. But now you can make it less using this technique. Well, we've got a paper going out next week in collaboration with our imaging core in which we're saying, well, actually, all you guys were wrong totally, because we can make it even smaller distance than we even thought possible, because we can throw away some rules that we didn't like to begin with regarding how light is actually, how light actually resolves structures. And it's just astounding how we can do stuff. Or what we're doing actually in this paper is, if the problem is that something is too small for
too
us
small
to be
to, a, see.
To see, then how can we make it bigger? So we just make the structure bigger. And I'm sort of sitting there, we can do this? Yeah, we can do this.
And you don't change the thing you're looking at by making it bigger?
No, because we're in the way we make it bigger. And this is a huge leap in technology, which comes from the simplest of things. What we do is use the basic material that's in baby diapers. And you know that stuff swells when it gets wet. That's the whole point of it, right? Well, what we've discovered is that if we embed tissues in that resin and we get it wet, that the tissue will expand.
And you can look at it better.
And we can look at it better. And so things that were at the limit of light resolution, actually below what we used to think of as the limit of light resolution, well, now we're making them 4 or 6 times bigger, and they're within our limit of resolution.
So what kind of things are you looking at this way that you couldn't see before? Like, what kinds of problems do you think you might be able to solve
now? How chromosomes pair. So we're able to ask the question of, what does it mean to be paired? When two chromosomes are physically paired, what does that actually mean? What do you actually see between two chromosomes that's paired that's not there when they're not paired? And so all of a sudden, this, you know, this
is kind of like the like, what is life on some level? Because when you're talking about this process that makes a new person or whatever, a new fruit fly, you're going to figure out how that works.
Well, you know, a long time ago, one of my undergraduates who was not exactly, well, actually, I would describe her as one of the most flippant people I know, introduced me to her parents at graduation. And what she said to her parents is, you know, I came to college to learn the secret of life, and I got Dr. Holly. And I turned to Rachel and I said, I did give you the secret of life. I told you how DNA works. And she sort of stared at me and I said, that's really all you need to know, Rachel. And she was fine. Okay, it got me out of that conversation really fast. So I was happy.
Well, you know, this brings me to, you write poetry, which, I don't know, is that common for geneticists?
I have no idea.
What do you write poetry about?
Pretty much anything. I mean, there's a quote that I need to find the author of how am I supposed to know what I think until I know what I've written? But I would change it to, how am I supposed to know what I feel until I know what I've written? And I write poetry. Poetry is a way that helps me understand what I feel. It's a way of being able to, words mean a lot to me. And I was raised in a time when it was really important to use the right word and to be careful about words. It's one of the things that I'm finding harder as I get older, is that it's okay to be sloppy with your words. And it's very important to me. And to be able to take the time in writing a poem to get the right word, and then to put words in an order, and then to realize it's not just the words, it's the way you construct the words, it's the way you construct the verse, it's the way you construct the rhyme, if you're going to do rhyme, that it takes on a meaning above the individual words. And for me, it's just such a powerful way. And it's also a way of me being able to communicate to people that matter in my life what it is I feel, when oftentimes my words fail me.
So you found a way to use words when words fail you?
Yeah.
Do you see any parallels between the process you're describing using language and the process that you've described regarding chromosomes and DNA?
I see a parallel in terms of doing science and poetry, in the sense of poetry allows me to fail. I mean, the vast majority of poems are, you'll get written 5, 6, 7, 8 times. It's rare when they don't. I mean, someone gave me a piece of wonderful news about a month ago, and I got the poem written as I was driving home from work, right? But that doesn't usually happen. I usually have to fail. I usually have to say, that doesn't work. I have to come back. I have to try something else. And in the process of what doesn't work, what doesn't feel right, then I manage to learn what does. And I manage to be able to put my words in a more meaningful sense and come up with something that matters.
Do you ever write about science?
I do.
In the poetry form, I guess?
I do. And because there's some beautiful stuff that I see. And every occasionally, especially, someone will bring an image into my office or shoot it to me on a computer. And I open the image or I look at what they're holding in their hand. And in a couple of minutes, I'll get to the science. But for the first minute or two, I just get struck by the beauty. There's a picture that sits in a frame right next to my lab manager's desk. It's also on my desk. And it's when we first visualized this structure inside the meiotic cell. And I can remember right now what I felt when I saw that image for the first time. And it was so beautiful. And it took me, as I said, a minute or two to step back and go, okay, what are we actually looking at? What does this tell us? What question did this answer? What is the question we need to ask? How do we make sure this is the right thing? You know, the usual sort of self-questioning things that are science. But for the first minute or two, I was just struck by it. This image is so beautiful.
And you worked through that with poetry?
A little bit in the next week or so, yeah.
When you think about, you talk about the beauty of just something you saw in your scientific observations. When you think about your career, like the big scope of your career so far, do any moments stand out as breakthroughs, like major aha moments, whether they're the ones that the field of science would point to in your career or not, just the ones that for you were moments that you might need to write a poem about?
Three or four.
Can you tell us about one of them?
Yeah, it was a long time ago, and as is usual for me, I was very overdue on a manuscript. And the reason I was overdue on the manuscript was because I couldn't figure out what the data were really telling me. I mean, the people in my lab thought they knew, but I felt like there was more in there. I felt like there was a lot more in there, and that I wasn't getting it, that nature was hitting me over the head with a 2x4, and I just wasn't getting it. And I ended up staying in the lab one night, overnight, trying to work on this manuscript because I was so late on it. It was so overdue. And finally, at one point, for reasons I'm not totally spit clear of, I typed this table. And I don't really remember why I typed it, and I just put it aside on my desktop. But the next morning, I came in and I looked at that table, and I realized, oh my gosh, there are two processes. We've been writing this entire paper. We've been thinking about this as if there's one. And what this table says is that there are two. And that was such a brilliant aha moment for me that when I just looked at the data, I just got myself in a tired enough place that I was just putting data down in a very raw sort of, this is what they are, unfiltered form. And then when I came back and I looked at it, oh my gosh, wow. And same thing when Kathy showed me that my lab manager and the research director of my lab. I mean, just wow.
What did it tell you? I mean, in terms of you saw things differently when you came in the next day. Was that the extent of what was incredible about this, or were there
repercussions?
Everything.
It changed everything. It changed how we thought about the problem, and you know, I'll say with perhaps a lot of immodesty, it changed the way other people thought about the problem.
Which problem?
This was a specific question about a subsystem of the meiotic process and how it works. And I had thought there was one system, and so had everyone else. And it wasn't making sense. I mean, everything we did was just not making sense. And all of a sudden it did.
Thanks, Scott Hawley, for explaining, you know, really taking us into the process of scientific discovery. Thank you so much.
It's my privilege. Thank you so much.
Scott Hawley is a geneticist with Stowers Institute. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear a story from KCUR morning announcer Michael Byers about the time he spent New Year's Eve playing Missile Command. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're going to take you back to a storytelling event back in March. KCUR's Michael Byers was one of the storytellers, and we chatted with him on this show before the event. He told us a bonus story that took place on a New Year's Eve long, long ago. Hi, Michael.
Hello there.
So you're probably getting sleepy right now.
Oh, yeah.
The theme of next week's event is Up All Night. And I thought of you because a lot of us experience that the true sign of an all-nighter is being up so long that we hear your voice before going to bed.
I've heard that, yeah. A lot of people have told me that they've been on the way home from a party or from a show or something like that. And yeah, they catch me as they're getting ready to go to sleep.
Well, rather than getting your whole bio here, I want to gather some random factoids about your life by way of a lightning round of, I would say, arbitrary questions.
Uh-oh.
And then you'll tell us a story. How does that sound to you?
Sure.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had, I went through the McDonald's drive-thru and had a sausage McMuffin and hash browns and an unsweetened tea.
I hope you enjoyed it, but in concern for your health, we can talk about that later.
Okay.
Do you have any party tricks, special talents, that kind of thing?
I can cross one eye at a time.
Whoa.
Which I know, and yes, he's single. I know, it's hard to believe. But yes, for whatever reason, I'm able to cross either eye individually, separately from the other.
Tell me about your first car.
My first car was a 1966 Impala Supersport that my father found for me. We bought it from an old lady who only drove it to church on Sundays.
Good choice.
Yeah, it was a really neat little car. It looked so sporty and so cool. And it lasted for a while until I got sideswiped coming home one night by a hit-and-run driver. And then it just sort of lost its appeal because it looked like an accordion on the driver's side.
Your first crush?
Her name was Candy. We'll just leave it at that.
He grows wistful.
Yes.
A nickname and where it came from?
Ross.
What?
Ross.
That's just another name.
It's another name / nickname / on-air name. Back when I did mornings for another radio station here in Kansas City for a short while, and when I came on, they already had two on-air personalities named Mike and Michael, so I was told, okay, we need to come up with something different for you, something snappy, one syllable preferably. So a couple of us sat around and brainstormed, and it came down to a choice between Ross and Zippy.
Hmm.
And I'm really glad that I went with Ross.
Your cocktail of choice.
I love the Cortez the Killer is the name of the cocktail that they serve at Manifesto. It's a mezcal drink, my first exposure to mezcal, very smoky and very savory. And it also has a mango habanero infusion, so it's got a whole lot of fire for the first sip or two. But then once you get used to the heat, you get that really intense kind of smoke and savory feel, and it's really good.
Your least favorite chore?
Cleaning out my car. I should do it more often. It's one of those things that my mom would always say, you know, if you just took stuff out of there as you put it in, you wouldn't have these big messes. I know I'm a procrastinator and I'm lazy. I'm sorry.
Best cure for insomnia?
No clue. I have no idea. I get insomnia a lot, so I don't know.
Your spy name, if you get to choose one.
My spy name?
Yeah.
This
is theoretical.
Theoretical spy name. The Caffeine Man.
And now this one's leading up to a story you're going to tell. Favorite video game of all time?
My favorite video game of all time, Missile Command.
So when Michael and I talked about what story he'd tell at this event, he had two options that he couldn't pick between, and they were both great. So the story you're about to hear is the one we didn't choose on a technicality, because technically Michael was not up all night in this story. He was just up really insanely late.
It wasn't quite an all-nighter. It was close, but still, like you said, technically it was not, so it was no good.
So both stories are good. You're going to have to go to the event at Knuckleheads to hear the other one, but Michael, tell this story. It begins in high school up north, right?
Up north, just out of high school. This was back when the video games started to sort of take the place of pinball machines, and arcades were popping up all over the place. There was this one game called Missile Command it was new and it was very popular, and I started playing it because all the cool kids were doing it, and I discovered that I was halfway decent at it, and there was a little unspoken competition between two other guys and me to have the high score of the arcade. One day, a guy named Nino broke 100,000, and everybody hailed him as a king, and then a few days later, a guy named Robert had 200,000, and he was given the same treatment. And then one day, just out of the blue, I almost hit 400,000, and the other two guys said, okay, we give up, you win.
So 400,000, just to be clear, is a really good score.
It's a pretty good score for that game, yeah.
Now set the scene at this arcade a little bit more for us before we proceed, just so we can picture it.
Okay, well, it had a combination of pinball machines along one wall and arcade games along the other and some sort of in the middle. It was called Wizard's Arcade, and it was on 72nd and North Oak up in Gladstone. And I went there all the time. I got to know a lot of the people that were there. It was a social hub as well as a opportunity to spend quarters and waste time.
And you went there with a couple of friends all the time, right?
Had a bunch of friends that we would go there sometimes and go to other places other times. It was just sort of, it was kind of a rite of passage. It was a sign of the times because, like I said, video games were becoming super popular. And it was one of the few times that I was popular because I was fairly decent at one of the games.
And you and your friends sang harmonies sometimes?
Occasionally. They had a jukebox that would come on, and I had a couple of other friends of mine, both named Scott, as it turns out, one from North Kansas City, one from Park Hill, and me being from Winnetonka, we were sort of the united colors of Betanton, of high school camaraderie. But every once in a while, something would come on by the Beatles or the Cars or Journey or something that had like a harmonic chorus, and we'd sing harmony, and it was fun.
So we're going to get back to you are starting to beat out the local competition.
Yes.
And what is the name of the game again?
Missile Command.
And you're doing that with a score of 400,000?
I first kind of jumped ahead of the pack with about 400,000, and then I kept playing, and I would get 500,000, 600,000. Eventually, I broke a million, and people lost their minds.
How did they lose their minds?
They're just screaming and cheering. It was like I was a football star or something like that. That's how popular the video games were at the time. It was a fairly new technology, and people just, anything new, people gravitate to. And if you happen to have some proficiency at it, then people gravitate to you as well.
So you're breaking now a million.
Yes.
How does the story progress from there?
New Year's night, 1980, that's where I went for my New Year's night, because my friends were there again, and about 9 o'clock-ish, I started playing a game of Missile Command, just because, and I just kept playing, and I kept going, and I didn't really have any idea of time. I just was completely focused on the game, and I continued, I just kept going and kept going, and all of a sudden, I felt somebody punch me in
Wait,
the shoulder. What?
I don't want to get to the shoulder punch yet.
Not yet? Okay.
You have figured out a kind of trick.
Well, okay, there was a glitch in the game where for some reason whenever you reached 810,000, it would automatically refresh these cities that you're supposed to be guarding. You'd get bonus city after bonus city after bonus city, and you basically could be invincible for about 20 minutes.
So you have figured that out, and that's part of why you're kind of unstoppable.
I was able to get to that level, and it would get me from 810,000 to, let's say, 1,000,002 or something like that. And then from there, if I could get to 1,810,000, it'd start again.
So you've started playing at 9 p.m. on New Year's Eve,
mm-hmm.
and you're playing and playing and playing.
Mm-hmm.
You're in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
Take it from there.
Mm-hmm. And I kept going, and then, as I said, I got punched in the shoulder. And it kind of snapped me out of my trance that I was in. And I had no idea what was going on. And I looked around, and it was the owner of the arcade. He smacked me in the shoulder, and I looked around. Nobody else was there.
And this is on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, New Year's Eve / New Year's morning. And I asked him what was going on. He said, Mike, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I was supposed to close at 1:30. It's 3 o'clock. I kept waiting for you to lose. You're just not stopping. And I got to go home. I'm sorry.
Now, what you clearly had missed, like, the midnight New Year's brouhaha.
I missed all the fun, yep.
What do you know about this time during which your awareness is gone?
I found out the next day that there was a lot of people standing around cheering for me every time I broke a million. And then when midnight came and it was Happy New Year, a couple of girls gave me a kiss on the cheek while I was playing. And I never knew.
Michael, so what ended up happening with your amazing abilities in this game?
The owner called an arcade in Ohio that kept track of all the scores and everything and reported my score, which was 8 million plus. They told him at the time that was a world record. And for about 2 weeks, just 2 weeks, if that, I was the world record holder of the game.
When's the last time you played?
Really serious? I really didn't play that much at all. I went about 25 years after that before I played it again. I just very rarely do. I figured, I got it all out of my way one shot.
Yeah, you're not going to break the world record again.
No, I don't think so.
Thank you, Michael.
Absolutely.
And that brings today's show on KCUR Central Standard to a close. We've been playing our best ofs from the year all week this week. And if you want to listen back to the one you heard today or any time this week, you can go to kcur.org/Central Standard and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST and we'd love to talk to you anytime. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman and have a really happy new year. See you in 2018.